It's time for Fed Talk, the live show for Feds in the know. From federal agencies to Capitol Hill, the attorneys of Shaw, Bransford, and Roth bring in experts from across the federal community to bring you inside the issues. Fed Talk is meant to provide general information about legal issues. However, the views expressed in this program are not intended to provide legal counseling. Listeners are cautioned not to rely upon any statements made in resolving legal issues they may face, but instead to consult with their own attorney about specific situations. Attorneys are not engaged in providing legal services while appearing on the program and are not responsible in any manner for the consequences that may stem directly or indirectly from reliance on any statement made during this program.
Good morning. Welcome to Fed Talk. I'm Bill Bransford, and I'm your host this morning. And today, we're going to be talking about last week's Federal Dispute Resolution Conference that was held in Atlanta, Georgia, attended by some 1,200 federal employees who had a great conference, a great learning experience, a lot of hot-button issues. And I've got on the show this morning three of the stars of last week's FDR conference, and I am pleased and proud myself to serve as FDR's program chair and looking forward to next year's conference. And if you're interested in attending that, you can save the date. It's August 8th through 11th, 2011, in Palm Springs, California. And you're going to get just a sampling today of what went on this year, and hopefully next year's conference will be even better. We're going to talk first with Veronica Villalobos, who is the EEO director at the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, a member of the FDR Board of Advisors. She helps plan the program each year. And she was instrumental in putting together a great plenary session and also some other workshops that she participated in. Second, we're going to hear from Sarah Spooner from the Federal Labor Relations Authority, and she's going to talk about the B-1 bargaining issues, the labor management forums, and some of the training the FLRA is doing on that topic. And then finally, we're going to end the session with a discussion from one of FDR's regular presenters, Barbara Haga, who's going to give you just a sampling of some of the ideas for federal employees and managers about leave and time and attendance from her workshop at FDR. But first, I'd like to welcome Veronica Villalobos. Veronica, welcome to Fed Talk.
Good morning. Thank you, Bill. It's great to be here with you today.
And Veronica, tell our listeners a little bit about what you do.
I am in charge of the EEO complaint processing here at EEOC, as well as the Affirmative Employment Program. We do everything we can to make sure that we have a diverse and equitable and inclusive workplace, just like we ask every other agency to do. So that's my job, making sure we look like we're asking other agencies to look.
And, of course, you've been, I think, for several years now, a member of the Federal Dispute Resolutions Advisory Board. And you help plan the conferences, and I think you just also had a recent experience that somewhat broadened your horizons. So could you tell our listeners about that?
Sure. I did indeed go over to the Office of Personnel Management to work with Deputy Director Griffin on the diversity work group that OPM is leading, and that was a great experience. I was there for 4 months. We helped start the strategic plan to create a more diverse and equitable and inclusive workplace.
And Veronica, I've heard over the years that OPM and EEOC, when it comes to the federal workforce, sometimes don't always see the issues the same way. What do you think about that observation?
You know, there's some truth to it. I mean, we're going to take it from different approaches. It's going to be the EEOC approach, and then there's going to be the Office of Human Resources approach, or the OPM approach. But I think there's a lot of areas where we're meeting together now, and the two agencies have worked very hard, both EEOC and OPM, to create a model employer in the federal government. And so we're starting to see that movement towards working together, and we've done a lot in that area just in the last several, I'd say 9 months or so.
And I'd like to talk just a little bit more about that, because I think one of the highlights of last week's FDR conference was bringing together your new chair, Chair Jacqueline Berrien, and the Deputy Director of OPM, Christine Griffin, for a discussion about how that was working, about how OPM and EEOC are working together, the kinds of issues they're working on. Tell us a little bit about that session, Veronica, which I think you were instrumental in putting together and also in moderating.
Sure. Well, it was a fabulous session with these two agency leaders talking to us very passionately about what it means to be a model employer. What I heard from Chair Berrien was that EEOC thinks it's important that we secure a strong and prosperous nation through a fair and inclusive workplace, and it was very clear that that includes the federal employer. It includes equity for achieving government services and resources that are given to everyone, right? We serve everybody. And then what I heard from Deputy Director Griffin was just a real passion about making sure that every voice is at the table, that there is inclusiveness in our workplaces such that we're able to reach all segments of society, that we're able to tap into all the talent that's available. And so it was just nice to hear the same message, slightly different language, but the same idea.
And just a reminder to our listeners that Fed Talk is brought to you by GEICO, where 15 minutes could save you 15% on car insurance. For more information go to geico.com. And also, I'd like to remind our listeners, this show is being presented to you live. I know it's late August and a lot of people are on vacation, but if you are listening and if you would like to join in the discussion, if you have a question or a comment, our toll-free number is 1-877-936-9333, or you can email us at fedtalk@federalnewsradio.com. So, Veronica, give me a little bit of an idea of those areas for federal employees where OPM and EEOC have overlapping responsibilities and jurisdiction.
Sure. Like one area, for example, is President Obama recently issued the executive order on increasing federal employment of individuals with disabilities. And so what we're called upon to do in that executive order is to work together. OPM is taking the lead, but they are to work with EEOC and Department of Labor and Office of Management and Budget. And so we have to come up with strategies to increase the number of people with disabilities.
They've actually been dropping in recent years, I think.
It has been. It's stayed level at about 0.88%. And so that's one example of an area where we're working together, and we do have that dual authority. Also, with respect to monitoring hiring, to also making sure that we retain and develop a diverse and inclusive workplace. Those are all areas where there's overlap. Just recently, we issued the applicant flow data memorandum, and this is an area where EEOC and OPM are strongly encouraging federal employers to collect applicant flow when people apply for jobs.
What's the purpose of applicant flow data?
Well, what happens is you're able to analyze it and compare it to who gets hired versus who applied, and then you can see whether you need to tailor your recruitment efforts. Maybe you're missing out on a lot of talent in one part of the country or from certain schools, and so you can look at this applicant flow data. You don't see the individual, you just see the data and figure out what areas you might want to do some different recruitment in.
And with respect to diversity. I understand that there might be a new policy coming out on that. Can you talk about that a little bit?
You know, I can speak kind of broadly about it. When I was over at OPM doing the detail, we were working on a strategic plan. There were, I think, 29 members from different agencies that were participating, identifying strategies on hiring, recruitment, retaining individuals. And we want to make sure that this is a workforce that is filled with lots of ideas, right, a diversity of thought. And so that was the effort there. I know that OPM is currently hiring a director of diversity, and so that they will be helping usher through this initiative and working on these strategies.
And one of the other highlights of this year's FDR conference was the appearance of your new chair, Jacqueline Berrien, who's only been there a few months now, I think. And can you tell our listeners a little bit about her vision as the new EEOC chair, particularly as it applies to the federal community?
Sure. She made it very clear that we need to create a very strong and prosperous nation by making sure that we have a diverse and equitable workplace. And equity in services is a key component of what we do as a government, and that is our mission. Every single one of us provides services and resources, and we need to create a federal workforce that looks like the people that we serve. And she talked about the importance of doing that and the importance of bringing diversity into the workforce, but also about not forgetting that the EEO complaint process is actually a place to learn as opposed to a negative. And I thought that was an interesting approach that she took to it. I think often we see it as a negative, right?
Well, there must be a problem, but it's also like, well, if these problems exist, how can we identify them and look for solutions?
Right, exactly. And that's what she talked about. How do we eliminate the barriers? How do we look at it systemically and individually? And it was just really nice to hear her speak with such passion about these issues.
Okay, you're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm talking to Veronica Villalobos about the FDR conference last week, and we're specifically talking about the new diversity and initiative and other areas of cooperation between OPM and the EEOC. And we'll continue our discussion after this break and a word from our sponsor.
And now, a word from our good friends at GEICO, where you could save 15% on car insurance. By now, you've no doubt seen those car insurance commercials with the talking gecko on TV. He's always talking about how people could save 15% or more switching to GEICO. Well, that sounds like a pretty good deal in and of itself. But get this. If you're an employee of the federal government, you may be eligible to save even more than that. That's something that GEICO didn't mention in all those commercials. And you've probably heard many times about how many people have switched to GEICO. Millions. But what you might not know is how many people stay with GEICO once they've switched. In fact, on average, GEICO customers who are federal employees have stayed with the company for over 20 years. Now that's customer satisfaction. Sound like a good deal to you? Then just call GEICO at 1-800-947-AUTO or go online to geico.com and find out how much you could save.
Welcome back to Fed Talk. I'm Bill Bransford. I am talking right now with Veronica Villalobos from the EEOC. We're talking about some of the programs that were presented in detail last week at the FDR conference in Atlanta, Georgia. In a few minutes, I'll be talking to Sarah Spooner from the FLRA, Federal Labor Relations Authority. And if you'd like to join our discussion, our toll-free number is 1-877-936-9333. Or you can email us at fedtalk@federalnewsradio.com. One of the interesting things that I think that occurred this year was the recognition of the 1,200 people or so that were at the FDR conference of how important it is, this new era of OPM and EEOC working together. And Veronica, I said, you know, you went over to OPM on a detail from your regular job at the EEOC. Christine Griffin, who's the deputy director, was previously an EEOC commissioner. And of course, Chair Jacqueline Berrien is new. But, you know, there seems to be the right approach of getting together, working in collaboration, which did not exist well before. How is this going to be sustained? Was there any discussion about that?
Yes, there was. You know, we always hear about sustainability, and a lot of people don't really know what it means, I think, when it comes to how we're going to do it for EEOC in this era of cooperation with OPM. What we have done is we've put in place formal meetings. We have a memorandum that talks about coordination between the two agencies, and we recognize that there are certain areas where we have overlap. But this isn't only happening at the higher levels. We're also making sure that at the staff levels, we're working together so that those relationships are built and this kind of meeting and collaboration can become ingrained in the culture of the two agencies. So as someone who's actually just a member of the staff, I see it myself every day. You learn people's names, they know who you are, and we share information, we share data, and we make sure that we utilize each other as resources.
And you think you're doing that to a greater extent than previously existed?
Oh, certainly, certainly. I think just even going to meetings, learning people's names and exchanging numbers, you know, there's just a greater level of cooperation between us. We're able to just pick up the phone and call someone when we need some assistance.
Yeah. Veronica, I think at the FDR conference, you also did the EEO case law update, which was, I know, was well attended and a very popular session. Can you give us just one or two examples of what you talked about in the case law update?
Sure. You know, there was one case that I just thought was great. It was Bowers versus Department of Defense, and that case stood for the idea that an individual who is being reassigned as a reasonable accommodation is not required to compete for a vacant funded position. And I think that's a well-established area of the law, but people forget that that's the rule. There you had an individual who had to heavily rely on one hand because she had an impairment in the other hand, and there was no reasonable accommodation that would allow her to perform her current position as quickly as she needed to, right? So she applied for a Privacy Act specialist position, and she didn't have to apply, but she did apply. It was this vacant funded position, and she asked if she could be reassigned. Well, they ended up not reassigning her. They actually put the prior incumbent into the position who wanted the position back, and she was without a job at that point. And we found that that was a violation of the Rehabilitation Act because you are supposed to put someone into a vacant funded position as a reassignment. They don't have to compete for the job. I thought that was a really interesting one.
Actually put them in because I think that the law as it developed on that at one point was the agency only had to consider, but you actually found this person had to be placed in the job.
Yes, she did, because she was qualified for the position. She was, in fact, able to do all of the work, and she had identified it. It was vacant when she identified it, so they should have placed her in the position.
Well, Veronica, thank you very much. Thank you so much for your work last week at the FDR conference and in planning the conferences over the years. And I look forward to working with you to make next year FDR 26 in August of 2011 a great success. Thank you, Veronica.
Thanks so much, Bill. Bye-bye.
I'd now like to turn to Sarah Spooner from the Federal Labor Relations Authority. Sarah, welcome to Fed Talk.
Hi, thank you for having me. I'm very happy to be here.
And you didn't actually get to attend this year's FDR conference, I believe.
No, I didn't. Our chairman, Carol Waller-Pope, was there, as well as representatives from our Federal Service Impasses panel and representatives from other member staffs as well, giving presentations, but I wasn't able to be there.
But you also were involved in getting things ready for your agency's participation in the conference, so I'd like to have you on to talk about one of the topics that came up last week, which was the Federal Labor Management Relations Council forums, and also the B1 bargaining pilots, which there was some discussion about that. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about what's going on there?
Well, at this point, with respect to the council, we are at a point where agencies who are participating in the B1 bargaining pilots. These are pilots that the executive order provides that certain agencies will participate in a pilot where they agree to bargain over B1 matters. And it may be all matters that are covered under 7106 B1 of the Federal Service Labor Management Relations Statute. It may be all or it may be some. And the executive order provides that these pilots will take place for a particular period of time, and the parties will test bargaining over B1. They will report back to the council, and then the council will in turn report to the president on the effectiveness and the impact of bargaining over B1 matters with respect to mission performance, improvement in labor management relations, as well as employee work life. So at this point, there are seven agencies who are represented on the as pilot participants, and those agencies are Department of Homeland Security, Department of Defense, Department of Labor, Treasury, Veterans Affairs, OPM, as well as Social Security Administration, and they have all agreed to engage in a pilot program. And those agencies are in the process of submitting or have already submitted to the council their plans for their B1 pilots.
And I know, Sarah, years ago when I used to work for the government, when I was doing labor law, we were always concerned about whether something was negotiable or not. And that's, of course, one of the FLRA's responsibilities. If it's something's a management reserve right, it's not negotiable. But B1 kind of cuts into that a little bit. What's the FLRA's role going to be in this, in defining the limits of what management's obligations are in labor relations as we move forward?
Well, 7106B comes from the statute that we administer, and there are years and years of case law addressing what constitutes a 7106B matter. And so the authority, and there's a, I should mention that there is a work group, which is a subcomponent of the council, that formed to address the and set out the criteria for the B-1 pilots. And our chairman, Carol Waller-Pope, sits on that work group. And the chairman offered training from our agency because of our expertise, because of the fact that the body of case law that we've developed defining what constitutes a B-1 matter, offered to provide training to all of the pilot programs on B-1. So our role at this point, and in fact, I'm happy to report that this week we actually provided the first of this training to not a group that's part of one of the pilots that the council has set up, essentially, but National Credit Union Administration and NTU agreed to participate in a pilot program. And this week, the FLRA was able to provide them training on B-1 law, the case law, as well as provide them with some consensus decision-making training, interest-based bargaining techniques, and relationship-building training to get their pilot going. So at this point, the FLRA's role is going to be to provide support to those pilot programs by providing them training and helping to get them up and running.
That's very interesting that you've thought this ahead. I guess when I look at it, excuse me, remembering back to my labor relations days, since B-1, as written in the statute, says it's at the election of the agency can always say, we choose not to elect, but the executive order actually requires the agencies that are in the pilot program to participate. How's the FLRA going to enforce that?
Well, as you know, the executive order is not enforceable, so we would not have a role in requiring agencies to bargain over B-1.
So that would be enforced more through the political channels of in the chain of command, I guess.
Yeah, there's nothing in the executive order that would place that before the authority and provide us with jurisdiction over something like that.
So, and one of the other, you know, one of the other topics that FLRA, it was a labor relations type program, was on. There was a workshop at the FDR conference on how to have an effective labor management forum. And I found it very interesting being in Atlanta last week, talking to people in the field with some of the challenges they were experiencing as they get these forums up and running. Are you doing anything to help agencies to create good, effective, productive labor management forums?
Absolutely. We have been, the FLRA partnered with FMCS right at the beginning, and we have been going out and providing training. We've trained well over 300 participants on the development of a labor management forum, as well as the relationship aspects and what goes into partnering and developing your relationship. This is something that our Office of General Counsel and FMCS have been putting on, for months now. We've done, they did two programs in Washington, one in each of our regional offices, and now they recently announced a second offering of this. It's basically an open training program, and we ask labor and management to come together and attend the training together, and they get 2 days of training on the executive order, training on rights and responsibilities under our statute, the Federal Service Labor Management Relations Statute, as well as relationship development work. And we have also been providing this training on request, specialized programs at agencies all over the country. So we're actively seeking to support agencies and unions in their forums.
Yeah. And tell me if I've got this wrong, Sarah, but I believe this training is at no cost to the agency?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Which is wonderful, because that's not always found.
Yeah.
And one of the requirements is that the agency labor relations specialist or manager, whoever's involved for the agency, has to attend with their union counterpart.
Correct. And this is a partnership effort, and we're encouraging parties to work together.
Okay, we're going to stop here to take a short break. When we continue, when we come back, we'll continue our discussion with Sarah Spooner. We'll talk a little bit more about the FLRA. You're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
And now, a word from our good friends at GEICO, where you could save 15% on car insurance. When you say that you work for the federal government, many people out there immediately picture you wearing a suit, driving a government-issue sedan, and living in D.C. While that may be true for some, in reality, federal employees have a wider variety of jobs than most people could ever imagine, from postal workers to CIA agents, from working in an office to working in outer space. These jobs are all so different that it's hard to believe they have something in common, but they do. And that similarity is GEICO. As employees of the federal government, many of these people may be eligible for additional discounts on top of GEICO's already low rates. And just because the cost is lower doesn't mean that GEICO's service is anything less than top rate. So whether you're in animal control or air traffic control, call GEICO at 1-800-947-AUTO. Or go online to geico.com and find out how much you could save.
I'm Deborah Roth, host of Fed Talk and partner at the law firm of Shaw, Bransford & Roth. Our firm specializes in helping federal employees with legal issues concerning their jobs or benefits. For two decades, we have been representing federal employees in adverse action cases, employment discrimination complaints, inspector general and internal affairs investigations, security clearance issues, and other federal employment disputes. If you have a legal concern, don't wait. Call Shaw, Bransford & Roth at 202-463-8400 or visit our website at shawbransford.com.
Welcome back to Fed Talk. I'm Bill Bransford, and I'm your host. I have on the phone right now from the FLRA, Sarah Spooner. And in a few minutes, we're going to be talking to Barbara Haga from Federal HR Services. We're going to be talking about leave issues with her. But right now, we're talking to Sarah Spooner about some of the new initiatives at the Federal Labor Relations Authority. Sarah, you were talking about this training. And I'd like to share with you an insight that I gained last week at the FDR conference and talking to a number of the participants. And what they tell me is that as they try to do these forums, one of the parts of it is they're supposed to involve unions in pre-decisional discussions. In other words, before management makes a decision to impose a program or policy change or something like that, they're supposed to involve the union, get their input, and then announce the change. And what the frustration was is they said as people develop this relationship, they engage in the pre-decisional involvement, they give the union everything they ask for, and then the union still wants to come in and negotiate with their using their collective bargaining rights. And maybe even litigate, if they feel like there's an unfair labor practice, and there was a feeling, a natural human feeling, that this was counterproductive to having a good working relationship. And I'm wondering if the training that is done by the FLRA and the FMCS deals with this kind of thing to help people recognize that people still have their rights, unions still have their rights, management does too, and how to deal with this new way of thinking and still have a good relationship.
Absolutely. I mean, as I explained before, part of what happens during this training is working on the relationship. Things have changed in labor relations over the years, and some relationships had soured, and practitioners that had worked together that had good relationships, many have left. And this is a new experience for so many people, that part of what our training attempts to do is to regroup them, reorient them to the way in which they deal with one another. And I should mention that we also provide support for forums moving forward through our Collaboration Alternative Dispute Resolution Office by being willing to facilitate meetings, to deal with them on issues on a day-to-day basis to support them better working together and managing this new relationship and the way in which they're going to deal with things.
So, and tell me a little bit more about how this training works. First of all, how can agencies sign up their people and their union people for the training that the FLRA and the FMCS are offering?
Well, for that joint training, you can certainly go to our website, check out. There is, under the Office of the General Counsel, there is a description of the training, the upcoming schedule, and the way to register for those sessions. Like I mentioned, we are now on our second offering, going around and providing these trainings in each of our regional offices. But if you have a need for a particular agency, a location where you've got a large number of people that you'd like to get trained, then to contact our Office of General Counsel and the headquarters office, and someone there can help sort of coordinate and determine if it would be best for you to attend one of these standing programs that are open to everybody, or if we can design one that would work just for your agency and union.
And I think that's very important for agencies to realize, because I think most of these forums at the local level are starting to maybe get up and running in June, or maybe they're working on them right now.
Right.
And I think agencies may not always appreciate that, you know, there's going to be some issues that come up, and there is a very good source available for them. You know, one of the things I heard is that the FMCS's part of the training really helps focus on that relationship, how to deal with the give and take that's going to occur in labor relations. Are you familiar with what the FMCS as part of the training covers? Can you talk about that?
Yes, I am. I can talk a little bit about it, talking about the interspace bargaining techniques and consensus decision making. And I think the thing here is that this is not necessarily a one-time thing. These are relationships and changing how people deal with each other. And so this is an ongoing process. And our agency recognizes that and wants to provide support and training all along the way, so that folks shouldn't just feel if they attend one training session and they want more, they should call us. Call the General Counsel at their headquarters office, call our Collaboration Dispute Resolution, Alternative Dispute Resolution office, and we're there to support the success of this executive order. Our chairman's committed to it, and every aspect of our agency is committed to it.
Yeah, I remember back in, many years ago when I worked with the FLRA, it seemed like everything happened in the general counsel's office with an unfair labor practice charge or filing of a negotiability appeal with the authority. But what you're describing now is a much more proactive involvement, with the FLRA actually getting right in the middle of day-to-day labor relations.
Absolutely, and that's exactly what we want our parties to see us as being able to provide to them.
And this ADR that you offer, can you give me an example of how that might work, and what types of disputes might arise, and how you might assist an agency and a union in making them work better together?
Well, we have there are a number of different ways in which ADR can be useful. I mean, in particular, right now, we have, as part of our negotiability regulations, our collaboration alternative dispute resolution is available to help parties hold their formal case in abeyance and try and resolve their issues with respect to negotiability of particular proposed language. We also now just recently issued revised arbitration regulations, in which for the very first time we are providing alternative dispute resolution services to parties in pending arbitration cases that are before the authority on exceptions to an arbitrator's award.
And that's basically an appeal of an arbitrator's decision.
Exactly. And those regulations go into effect October 1st, but this was yet another way in which the authority was trying to make ADR available to parties to have them step out of the formal case processing and try and resolve their dispute on their own with the support of someone from our CADRO office. And CADRO is also available to provide facilitation as well for ongoing forum meetings or specific disputes. And, of course, another huge ADR component that we've got is in our Office of General Counsel. A few months ago, our General Counsel's office issued revised unfair labor practice regulations in which ADR was formally brought back into the processing of an unfair labor practice charge. And that was a big shift.
And, Sarah, moving forward to next year, I mean, it's been wonderful having the FLRA as a vibrant member of the of the FDR community. And of course, it's, you know, the idea is there are six federal dispute resolution agencies. One of them is the FLRA. We're going to be planning for next summer in August of 2011 in Palm Springs, California. And we look forward to having the FLRA as very much a part of that process. It sounds to me like you have a lot to offer. There's a lot going on and many, many programs and workshops that'll be quite relevant when next summer comes along. And I look forward to working with you on that.
Thank you. You too. We're really excited about being involved in FDR, and we look forward to next year.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Sarah, for joining us on Fed Talk today. And I'm waiting for our next guest. Barbara Haga is not quite on the line yet, but I'd like to talk just a little bit about what the kinds of things that she's going to cover. When she's at the FDR conference, she's always one of our most popular presenters. She works for Fed HR Services, and she's an absolute expert on federal leave. And when she comes on the line, we're going to talk to her about things like leave restriction letters and the federal FMLA, and when somebody can take leave or not. Barbara, I understand you're there.
I'm here.
And welcome to Fed Talk. It's great to have you on. It's great to have you on the show today.
Thank you for having me on.
And I was just trying to do a little filler there, and because I know a little bit about some of those leave rules, and I've done some training, not at the level that you do on that. It's a big problem for managers, particularly the managers, knowing the leave rules, because you know, from my perspective, having had managers as clients in my law firm, the employees have a lot of rights when it comes to leave.
Employees have quite a few rights, and over the past, you know, 15 years or so, leave has gotten incredibly complicated. When I started in the business, you had annual and sick, and you used sick if you were sick, and that was all there was to it. But now we have a variety of different uses of sick leave for the employee's own medical uses or to care for a family member, for adoption, and then the whole evolution that came with the Family Medical Leave Act in 1993 that added that whole category that we had never dealt with before.
So it's really important for managers to have an understanding of what the rules are. Tell us a little bit about yourself, Barbara. How did you get to be so knowledgeable about these subjects like federal leave?
Well, I spent 30 years working for the federal government. Most of my career was with Navy, and most of that was employee and labor relations work. So certainly issues related to leave were very common. And then my last 5 years of employment, I worked with NASA. And so it's just something, you know, that was sort of a natural part of what I did when I was working. And then after I retired, I was contacted about writing some books about the Family Medical Leave Act, and that sort of turned into a huge amount of training on that topic since then.
And I understand you've recently produced a video with LRP on leave. Can you tell us a little bit about
that? There are two videos. They're designed for supervisory training. The first one, they're both 45 minutes long. The first one is about all the various kinds of leave, sick leave, annual, leave without pay, military. And then the second one is specifically about the Family Medical Leave Act. And they're really designed to go together. And they've got some questions in them so you can stop and discuss the answers and then start the video back and the questions are answered. So it's a good tool for training, you know, on the basics.
And how does somebody get a copy of this video?
The website for that is Shop LRP, Labor Relations Press. And they just can purchase them through LRP, or if they want to contact me, they can, you know, reach me, and I can direct them to the website.
Okay, and so let's talk just about a couple of the items, and I just like to ask you some questions, because I talk to managers all the time. I hear their frustration in dealing with leave issues. They seem to center around, you know, medical documentation. You know, when do I have the right to request it? A couple of other areas like that. So I'd like to just ask you a couple questions and have you give our listeners just a little bit of an idea of what they could get if they hear you at next year's FDR conference if your session's repeated. And I think you've done it a number of years in a row for FDR, haven't you?
Some topic related to leave, usually, yes.
And so if our listeners want to come to next year's FDR conference, or if they want to go to the lrp.com website and purchase the video. So here's one of the things that I was that I dealt with for a number of years, and I heard feedback from managers before the first sick leave legislation passed last year. They were very upset about FERS employees using what they thought were abusing sick leave as they got to be a couple of years from retirement.
Sure.
And I would tell them about leave restriction letters the work I do for the Senior Executives Association put together some legislative initiative that actually led to the legislation. And as we were lobbying for this legislation on the Hill, OPM opposed it by saying that managers don't use the tools that they already have. And the only tool I could think of was a leave restriction letter. So is that the only tool managers would have in a leave abuse situation like what arose in the FERS sick leave?
Yeah, that's the tool.
That's the tool. And of course, it arises in other contexts as managers see a lot of employees taking off Fridays or Mondays or taking leave just when they're supposed to do a really important project and because the employee's got butterflies and they just can't quite get to work. I mean, it's the leave restriction letter. There's nothing else, right?
It is a leave restriction letter, and, you know, it's... If the employee is in a situation where they can get those medical certificates signed, and sometimes that's the case, even the leave restriction letter won't curtail it because all it takes is, a medical certification. So, you know, if they have some kind of a medical condition, whether it really affects them that often or not, sometimes they're able to produce a certificate, and then management really doesn't have much room to deny the leave. But you're absolutely right. I mean, when we saw the FERS Act in the early 80s, we knew exactly what was going to happen, that, you know, employees wouldn't, you know, leave all that leave on the books, that some would decide to use it, and that it would be a huge effort for managers to try to curtail it. So thankfully, we don't have that anymore to deal with. So now it's a question of convincing people that they should hold on to that leave, because that's a huge insurance policy to protect them if something happens to them. And in my trainings, I hear all the time of people with 15 or 20 years of service who have no sick leave. And it's not because they've had, you know, some terrible illness. It's just been sort of, you know...
They have a lot of headaches.
I have a lot of headaches, a lot of short absences, yeah.
And of course, the basic idea, tell us a little bit about, and I think most of our listeners probably experience this on a day-to-day basis, but there's actually a structure behind how sick leave is used and when medical documentation is required and why a leave restriction letter is the answer often for a manager. Tell us a little bit about how that structure is supposed to work.
Well, the employee is supposed to request sick leave in advance unless it's a last-minute emergency kind of thing. So once in a while, there would be something like the birth of a child or planned surgery where you might have advance notice. But usually there's some set policy in the agency about when the employee is supposed to call in and who they're supposed to speak to. And I find in my training a lot of managers haven't enforced that. They've allowed employees just to leave messages, and so they don't actually speak to them, they don't hear them, and so it's very easy to call in at 5 in the morning and leave a message and say, I'm sick. So that's one thing that managers can do to try to, you know, get a handle on, is at least set the requirements in place. And if employees don't follow leave procedures, then the leave can be denied. And most agency table of penalties will have a penalty on there about not following leave procedures all by itself, you know, whether there's a absence without leave or not. The other thing that normally the rule is after 3 days, medical certificates can be required. That's what the OPM regs say. But in a lot of agencies, I find they've gotten much more liberal over the years, and they're allowing self-certification pretty much routinely up to 5 days. So they don't really get medical in a lot of circumstances until somebody decides that the situation is gotten out of control, and that's when they often want to talk about the leave restriction letter. The leave restriction letter is always grievable because it puts a requirement on that employee that other people don't have to meet, so they have a way to challenge it, whether they've got a union or not. In most agencies, it's administratively grievable as well, and so that sometimes scares managers away that they're afraid they won't be sustained or upper management won't back them up. But if they issue the letter, then it requires a medical certificate for any increment of sick leave, even if it's 15 minutes. And the letter normally will say if they don't produce that, then the leave won't be approved. One caution, though, sometimes I get calls from agencies where they believe an employee is abusing Family Medical Leave Act.
Okay, can we come back to that just after the break? We have to take one last break to hear from our sponsor. When we return, we'll talk about the Family Medical Leave Act with Barbara Haga, who is an expert on federal sick and annual leave. You're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
And now, a word from our good friends at GEICO, where you could save 15% on car insurance. By now, you've no doubt seen those car insurance commercials with the talking gecko on TV. He's always talking about how people could save 15% or more switching to GEICO. Well, that sounds like a pretty good deal in and of itself. But get this. If you're an employee of the federal government, you may be eligible to save even more than that. That's something the gecko didn't mention in all those commercials. And you've probably heard many times about how many people have switched to GEICO. Millions. But what you might not know is how many people stay with GEICO once they've switched. In fact, on average, GEICO customers who are federal employees have stayed with the company for over 20 years. Now that's customer satisfaction. Sound like a good deal to you? Then just call GEICO at 1-800-947-AUTO or go online to geico.com and find out how much you could save.
Welcome back to Fed Talk. I'm Bill Bransford, and I'm talking to Barbara Haga. We're talking about leave abuse, and strategies for managers. We have just a few minutes left, but if you have a question, you can call us 1-877-936-9333 or email us at fedtalk@federalnewsradio.com. So before the break, Barbara, you were talking about the Family Medical Leave Act. Why does that pose a particular problem for managers?
Well, Family Medical Leave Act is an entitlement. So if the employee meets the conditions for using it, then they must be allowed to go. Now, for many things where it's the employee's own illness or family care, that might happen anyway under the normal sick leave rules. But one example of where an employee could require management to grant absence would be like a new father wanting to stay home after the new mother no longer needs care. Under sick leave rules, he's no longer covered, but he could require management to allow him to be off work by invoking the Family Medical Leave Act, and then in doing so require that they approve annual leave to cover his absence, where normally annual leave would be tied to workload.
Right, and if he doesn't have annual leave, they could require management to put him on leave without pay.
Family is leave without pay. But what I was starting to say before the break is those sick leave letters of restriction that very effectively sometimes can control sick leave can't be used for FAMLA. So there's on the OPM website, there's some questions and answers about FAMLA, and OPM has given their opinion that that's not authorized for Family Medical Leave Act substitutions.
But I understand from the Family Medical Leave Act regulations that OPM has issued that managers are entitled to medical documentation to show that the employee is actually suffering from a serious health condition and is entitled to use the leave.
They're entitled to the medical on their own the employee's own serious health condition or a family member's. The medical rule doesn't apply to new births or adoption.
Right, right.
The medical, if they use the WH-380 form, that Department of Labor form, it actually goes through all the questions that the medical report has to cover. And there are different questions for family members than for the employee. But you're absolutely correct. Managers are entitled to some information to invoke it, And then generally speaking, after that, it's going to be about every 30 days. There are specific rules about how long certifications apply for things like births of new babies and, you know, serious conditions like surgery and that kind of thing.
I think the challenge for managers is when they think a federal employee is constantly using a lot of leave, is using the Family Medical Leave Act, perhaps abusing it. So there's even some things that managers can do if they look at these regulations to kind of control the employee who tries to use the Family Medical Leave Act for that reason. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, they need to not grant FAMLA, you know, in any large way. I mean, a couple of days maybe, but don't do it until they get that medical report. And if something in the medical report doesn't seem quite right, there's certainly, you know, they've got their HR folks that they can contact about, you know, have we granted leave in this circumstance previously? And sometimes they have connections with medical staff that can review it and give a medical opinion about whether the this condition and the amount of absence makes sense together.
And one of the new, well, relatively new, I guess it's been a few years now since OPM modified their regulations to require employees to invoke FEMLA at the very latest within 2 days of returning to work from a FEMLA absence.
That's right. There's no more retroactive FEMLA.
And there were a couple of MSPB cases that allowed employees to invoke FEMLA at the MSPB hearing, and I think that's been effectively eliminated.
That's all gone now. So, yeah, the only time they can do retroactive is if the employee was completely incapacitated and so was their representative and no one could make the request, which would be a pretty rare circumstance.
Okay, we have just a minute or two left, Barbara. I'd like to go to one other management problem. So you mentioned before that the employee goes and gets a medical certificate for sick leave, but doesn't that medical certificate, I mean, it can't just be the doctor saying, Susie's my patient, please excuse her. Isn't the manager entitled to a little more information than that?
Yeah, the way I interpret it is, you know, there's six uses of sick leave. One of them, the one we're probably talking about here, is the one that says incapacitation. Well, the healthcare provider at least needs to say that. So something that says under my care or out of work, you know, X number of days doesn't really say that. So the it should at least say that they're incapacitated or can't perform, you know, the essential functions of the position.
And most doctors, you know, have enough ethics. They're not going to say that unless they really believe it.
Well, let's hope so.
There are, and I think there are a couple of places where people can go and get the doctor to say whatever they want. But you know, it was interesting. You talked about when you first started that it was very clear that you know, sick leave was only be used if you were sick and very, like, a family member had a contagious illness, like pink eye or something like that, was given as a specific example. But there, we have leave banks, we have donated leave, we have advanced leave. It's become complicated. How's a manager to learn all of this? Maybe watch your video.
Well, the videos would help. OPM has a tiny bit of information on their website. I mean, one of the things that I covered in the seminar with the HR folks and the legal folks that were there was you need to, you know, beef up those directives and provide all this detail about who's a family member and, you know, the family member cuts off at 18 under Family Medical Leave Act and get that information out there because people don't know. And, you know, it's so much easier if you know to say, you know, here's where the rule is.
Okay, Barbara, I'm going to have to cut you off because we are out of time, but that's just a small sampler of what you talked about last week at FDR or what people could learn from your video or what you could learn next year at the FDR conference. Thank you very much for being with us this morning. And I'd like to remind our listeners that Fed Talk is brought to you by the attorneys of Shaw, Bransford, and Roth, and we wish you a great weekend.